Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and welcome to War, What Is It Good For? Part 1. Today is Chocolate Bunny Day, or whatever you call it, or however you celebrate it, or don't celebrate it. And yesterday was April 4th, and that's the 11th anniversary of my son being killed in one of the U.S.'s illegal and immoral wars. So this week and next week, we'll be talking to a U.S. soldier and an Iraqi who was there during shock and awe in 2003. So our guest today for part one of War, Who Is It Good For? Is Kevin Benderman. Like I said, Kevin Benderman was a U.S. soldier who refused to deploy back to Iraq. After his first deployment, he had seen so many horrible things and what he considered were acts of war crimes. And he was also convinced that he was sent to Iraq based on lies and for profit. So Kevin will be telling his story this week and Raya Gerard next week. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Kevin Benderman, who has a very compelling story to tell. Kevin Benderman, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Cindy.
Well, Kevin, it's great to talk to you. It's been too long since we have had a chance to connect, but we are Facebook friends. So yes. I do see you on Facebook a lot, and that we can keep connected that way, which is good. Before we get into something that is like really near and dear to both of us, and I think that's accountability for the Bush regime. Uh-huh. I would like to, for you to tell my listeners about yourself and about your experience in Iraq and what that led to.
Well, I guess I should start by saying that I had two terms of service, and there was a split in between those times, but I went back in for my second enlistment in June of 2000. I was stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, and that is the 4th Infantry Division was the unit that I was deployed to Iraq with in 2003. But I always found it kind of funny that we were being told at the beginning of 2002 to be ready to be deployed to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And I was attending the primary leadership development course, which is what you go through for to become get your NCO rank. And while I was attending that, I was constantly being told we're leaving next month, we're leaving next month, we're leaving next week. And I kind of wondered why we would be going to Iraq when everything that was implied that was tied to Afghanistan and the 9/11 attacks. I couldn't understand why Iraq, but, you know, being a soldier, it's, you just do or die.
Uh-huh.
And, so we finally received our order for deployment in 2003, and we traveled over there to Kuwait. And we were setting up everything to cross the berm. And then once we got all our preparations made, we went into Iraq. And, you know, it was just kind of an odd thing to be over there. And
mm-hmm.
some of the first few things that we did that really started bringing it to my, to the forefront of my thoughts, that we were in the wrong place at the wrong time and for the wrong reasons.
Uh-huh.
About a month after we were there, we had traveled to the southwest area of Baghdad. I'm not sure exactly how far, but there was a, there was an oil pumping station and some storage tanks there. And my platoon, or excuse me, my company was tasked with guarding this platoon, and we were there for this area, and we were there for about a week. And I'm wondering why we were guarding an oil well and an oil pumping station when we were the only ones there. I mean, there was no one out there but us.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought that was kind of strange.
Right.
But, you know, we eventually continued north, and on the way to where we were going to set up in our operating base for a period of months while I was there, which was a town named Konkan. But we just saw and done some things that were extremely questionable in my mind. I mean, they were not very, I just couldn't see where they were technically necessary to be doing anything that, trying to accomplish a mission that they told us that we had to do. And that would bring, well, one of the reasons was to liberate Kuwait, I mean, to liberate Iraq, and
right.
From what and from who? I mean, picking on that, the general population the way we did, I couldn't see that that was bringing any type of liberation to any of those people.
Do you feel comfortable talking about anything that you said you were doing things and witness? I mean, your unit or company, they were doing things and you were seeing things that you didn't think were right. Would you feel comfortable elaborating on any of those besides guarding an oil well? You guys were the only ones out there.
Yeah. It's just, we would go with the scouts at times, and the scouts were like, our spearhead, so to speak. And they would be entering an area and they would go in, and then they would take some, what they call, term the EPW, the enemy prisoners of war. And me being in the platoon that I was in, we got tasked to transport some of these EPWs to a holding facility. But the people that we were picking up, they were not fighting. They did not possess any weapons. They weren't caught with weapons. We were just going into their homes and taking them out because somebody else had come along and said, well, this was my house. And we would just go in there on totally hearsay evidence and forcefully remove these people from their homes and take the male in the household as an enemy prisoner of war, and then the family would be just left out in the cold, you know, wives, children. It was just, I don't know, that was something that I would never expected to be doing as a professional soldier, if you
right.
understand what I'm trying to say.
Right. Can I tell you a quick story? I was in Jordan, and I was in Jordan in 2006, and we
right.
had some Iraqi come to Amman to meet with us because we couldn't go to Iraq. And so they were telling us their stories about things that happened. And this man, he was an imam or something. He said that he was dragged out of his house, beaten in front of his wife and son, and then taken into custody. And he said that his son, at that point said, I just have to kill Americans. I have to do everything I can to kill as many Americans as possible. And, so that was, to me, that was just a story out of really literally millions, that I think represents a lot of what you're talking about.
Well, sure, I can see that. I mean, and, you know, again, I can't. When I joined the military, initially and for my second enlistment. I never believed that I would be used to harass the local civilian population of a country who had never done anything to us.
Right.
I mean, maybe I bought the lie, but I thought if I would ever be sent to war, I would be in a war against other soldiers.
Uh-huh.
You know, my own enemy. And as messed up as that may be, that would be more acceptable to me than harassing civilians who had absolutely done nothing to us.
That's what I mean,
personally, I wish...
go ahead.
I wish that what war would, we could do away with it altogether, but in those two scenarios, when I did join the military, if I, like I said, if I thought that I was going to be sent to war, it would be against other soldiers and it would be within the rules of what we were and were not allowed to do. Everything we did over there was outside the law of land warfare and the Geneva Convention, which we were all taught from basic training that we absolutely had to follow these rules.
Wow. So you joined, you rejoined in 2000. That's when my son KC joined. It was like, he went to boot camp in, I think, August of 2000. And you were both stationed at Fort Hood. He was in the 1st Cavalry and didn't go over until March of 2004. But were you in the initial invasion? Were you in the, what was your unit?
Well, my unit, we were supposed, what we originally were told was that we were going to come in from the north through Turkey.
Oh.
We were supposed to have been over there. Yeah, we were supposed to have been over there long before 2003 getting everything ready, because we were going to, the 4th Infantry Division was going to come down from the north through Turkey, and we were going to meet with the Marines and the other divisions and some of the British divisions that were coming up from the south and the southeast, because, you know, the British were big, they were stationed around Basra.
Right.
But evidently, the negotiations between the U.S. government and the Turkish government didn't go through, and so we were postponed being deployed until March 2003. And yes, that was the initial invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm.
Right. So you, I believe there was an incident that caused you to take a stand. And so can you tell my listeners about that and then tell my listeners about the stand you took?
Well, there was no one single incident. I guess it was a conglomeration of many of the things that I saw and what we were doing while we were over there. But one of the strongest things that I put into the decision that I did was while we were in Konikin, when we first got there and was trying to secure the building that was in the middle of Konikin for the command post, before we could get it secured and cleaned up, some of the neighborhood children who had never seen anything like the American military, there was a wall around that building, and they would climb up on the wall, a brick-type wall. And they would laugh and, you know, and they would point and just doing what kids would do. You know? And some of them had even taken to throwing some small stones. You know, they weren't, I mean, didn't land anywhere near anyone inside our little command post. But the captain came out of that building one day while we were out there, and I was standing out there with about three other junior enlisted people. And he told us that if the kids got back up on the wall, to kill them.
Oh, my God.
Because, I mean, he came out and saw that we were telling them to get off the wall. He told us to shoot those children. And that's the thing that made me realize that it was entirely over the top and not anything that I'd want to be associated with.
Oh, absolutely. And then Did you come home on leave and then decide not to come back?
What happened? I had re-enlisted at Fort Hood before all this deployment started and was scheduled. And I was supposed to be sent to Fort Stewart, Georgia. And so, after I was there from March until September of 2003. They sent me back in September so I could go get all my stuff and PCS from Fort Hood to Fort Stewart.
Okay.
And so got all that taken care of, and we had, Monica and I had found a place to live and got all that stuff settled. We received notification of a second deployment. And during the time that we received a notification and the approaching date, I was doing a lot of soul searching about what I had done, what I had helped others do, and why we were even over there anyway. And we had some pretty intense discussions between Monica and me about redeployment. And at that time, I knew I shouldn't be going back over there. But it was a catch-22 kind of thing, because if I stood up and said anything, I knew I was going to go to jail.
Right.
And those were some of the intense discussions that she and I had. But ultimately, I made the decision to not redeploy to Iraq. I applied for a conscientious objector status because at that time, I thought that would be the best way to not be redeployed, to increase my complicity in terrorizing and destroying a nation and killing people that had done nothing to us.
Right, and then intentionally being ordered to kill children.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that was a direct order. I mean, that was
monstrous.
That wasn't a hint or just a play on words. He said, if those children get back on the wall, you need to shoot them.
This is just an aside, but was there anybody in your company that could tell the children in Iraqi that, you know, speak their language to tell them that?
No, there was no one in company at that time that spoke any of the Iraqi languages.
Right. So it was just like summary execution for climbing on a wall.
Yes. Oh, I mean, and I'm not talking 16 or 17 year old kids. I'm talking 9, 10, you know, that age range kids. I'm talking about children.
So many of them were killed, have been killed by the U.S. since 1991, so many children through four U.S. administrations have been bombing and terrorizing Iraq. It's just really super sad. So you decided not to go back, and then what happened?
Well, upon the decision to not go back, I applied for conscientious objector status with my unit and my rear detachment command. They claimed that I missed movement, they claimed at first that I deserted. And that I made disloyal statements to a commanding officer.
Right.
And they were trying to charge me with desertion. What they ultimately wound up charging me with was missing movement by design. But after going through the process of applying for conscientious objector status, and speaking with a chaplain on post who verified my claim that I didn't want to be back over there in a war, it was rubber stamped by everyone in my chain of command that they denied it unequivocally, without even reading it. None of them interviewed me. None of the people that stamped it and signed their name to the form that denied my conscientious objector status. Other than Captain Tavares, I've never spoke with any of the rest of them. there was a Colonel John Kidd, who was the garrison commander acting while the battalion or the division commander was already deployed. And I can't remember that major's name that was in that chain that stamped it as denied.
So then,
but I mean,
Go ahead.
Every one of them just like I said, rubber stamp denied without interviewing me or talking to me in any way.
Then did they institute court martial procedures against you?
Yes, they. They came to me, and they were first going to charge me with desertion and making disloyal statements. That fell through into Article 32, which is like a grand jury proceeding in the civilian world.
Mm-hmm.
But that fell through, so then they removed all those charges and came back with missing them by design. They were going to charge me with larceny because the finance department in my unit had started putting hazardous duty pay, family separation pay, and the tax exempt status that you get as a soldier from being deployed to a war zone.
Right.
They did that even though they knew I had not deployed to Iraq. And they were going to charge me with stealing money from the government, grand larceny.
Jeez.
And they were attempting to put me in prison for 7 years. That were the charges that they were trying to bring, that would have been the maximum time that they could have put me in prison for with those charges.
So then what actually ended up happening with the charges in the trial?
Well, most of the charges were dropped because during the Article 32 proceedings and beginning of the trial, it was found out that I had nothing to do with adding those additional monies into my pay.
Uh-huh.
So the judge just dismissed that charge outright. But ultimately, during the trial, I was convicted of missing movement by design and was convicted of 15 and a half months in confinement, demotion to private, and loss of all pay and privileges. I was sentenced to serve my time at the Fort Lewis Regional Correctional Facility.
Did you serve all that time?
I served that 15 months since I served 13 months of that.
Wow. How was that?
I got
2 months
off for good behavior.
Yeah, how was that?
Well, that was an experience in itself because the prison that they sent me to was originally designed, and the program was designed for soldiers that committed minor offenses and were going to be returned to duty.
Uh-huh.
They pretended like I was going through basic training all over again. And I kept telling them, look, I've been given a dishonorable discharge from the United States Army. Y'all don't have to play this game with me about trying to rehabilitate a soldier. I said, what are you going to rehabilitate me from anyway? Telling you I don't want to kill anyone?
Right.
Oh, but it was a battle. I mean, that place, it was cold in the winter because the windows weren't sealed properly. There were leaking sewage within the facility itself out of the open sewer pipe that ran along the ceiling.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding
because
me.
Because it was a two-story facility.
Uh-huh.
And the first floor would get sewage dripping on it from the pipes that ran from the second floor.
So, Kevin, I do want to talk about, you know, you went to prison for 13 months because you didn't want to kill people. But we still have George Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Rumsfeld.
Donald,
Donald Rumsfeld, all those people are not only not in prison, but they're prospering and seeming to lead very comfortable and happy lives. And so talk about that a little bit, because I obviously think that one of Barack Obama's biggest crimes against humanity and war crimes is that he is blocking any kind of accountability for the Bush regime, because of course he's doing many of the same things or worse. So talk about that a little bit, Kevin.
Well, by the time I was released from the original correctional facility in 2006, I was still, Bush was still president, and then the next couple of years, we started, let me backtrack just a bit. While Bush was still president, I saw thousands and thousands upon thousands of people protesting and calling for Bush to be convicted or at least put on trial for the illegal invasion of Iraq.
Right.
And then during the campaign of Barack Obama, he came out with his hope and change, and basically it was his version of Reagan's Morning in America again.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about accountability, this, that, and the other, but just on the eve of his election, he started talking about we need to look forward and not look back.
Right.
And so I, in my opinion, by him not taking any action as the president to appoint an independent counsel to investigate the charges and the allegations of war crimes being ordered to be undertaken by the Bush administration, I believe he is complicit in those particular crimes. I also believe that Nancy Pelosi is complicit when she said that impeachment was off the table.
Exactly.
And she only did that for political expediency.
Right.
And I have no use for someone that puts politics before justice.
Right. Absolutely. Because I totally agree with you.
Our nation is, we like to run around talking about how we are truth, justice, and the American way. Well, where is the truth and the justice that we are supposed to be exposing the truth and applying the justice to our political officials that blatantly break the law? I mean, they violated the Geneva Convention. They violated the Nuremberg Tribunal standards that was established after World War II to prosecute heads of state that started aggressive wars. And the war in Iraq was nothing but an aggressive war. There was absolutely no justification for us to invade that country and do what we did. None. Period.
Right, and now Obama wants authorization to use more military force in Iraq, and that's what happens when you don't hold war criminals accountable. The war crimes just keep continuing, administration after administration after administration. Well, Kevin, I know your story and, your struggles and I think this cost you your marriage. And do you have any regrets over the choices you made?
Yes, I do have regrets. I regret that I took the stand that I did, thinking that the American people would stand beside me and so that we could all work to hold these criminals accountable.
Right.
And what I regret is that as soon as the many of the protesters got the word from their political party to stand down and not pursue investigations and justice against the Bush administration, they just blindly obeyed their party and forgot all about justice. So yeah, I regret losing everything that I did for a country who ultimately didn't do anything about it. And I fought the people more than as much as I fought the politicians. because the politicians wouldn't continue to do this if the people weren't complicit in their silence in what these politicians are doing.
Right. I mean, exactly. But do you regret, you know, not going over there another time?
No, I don't regret not going over there.
That's what I always think. You know, I always think that I've given up so much in the struggle for peace and for justice. But does anybody even really give a damn, or has it really even done any good? But I just want to assure you that, you know, that there's a ripple effect, and who knows all of the good that was that happened and all of the evil that didn't happen because you refused to go over there. And your story and stories of other, brave people with integrity and, love of other people, that we can't forget those stories. We have to, that's why I'm having you on the show, because you did such an amazing thing. And, you know, at the time it was, I think you got a lot of support, but then I think it just you went to prison and then it just kind of, I don't want to say fizzled out, but your story just kind of died at that point. And it shouldn't have. It should still be, every young person should hear this story, Kevin, because I can guarantee you that what you did affected people to start understanding what this criminal government is about, and they refuse to participate in it by even signing up. So that's why we can't forget stories like yours. We have to keep telling these stories to stop other people from participating.
Well, if it helps a few people make a decision not to go to war, especially to be very critical in their support of wars, that they may feel as questionable, then it has done some good. I can't say that it hasn't done any good. And maybe my bar was set a little too high, because I really thought by now that we would have Bush and Cheney and the members of the Project for the New American Century, who were all in his administration,
right?
Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, etc. I thought that we would at least have some of them in the prison, or they would be so discredited they would never be able to show their face in public again. But that just didn't happen in this country.
Well, I'm with you. I thought that it would be by the end of 2005 or 2006 that these things would be happening. But certainly when the Democrats took over Congress in 2007, I believed at first that they would, because they lied to my face and said that if the anti-war movement helped them get elected, they'd help us end the wars. And then John Conyers, who was on the House Judiciary Committee, promised that he would institute impeachment proceedings against Bush and Cheney, which isn't prison, but, it's accountability. And I think Nixon would have gone to prison if Ford hadn't pardoned him. So I'm with you, Kevin. I believed that all of our sacrifice would actually result in justice.
Well, if I could say one more quick thing here.
Sure.
I've looked back on some of the history of Vietnam, and I've learned quite a bit since 2004, when I started really digging into a lot of this stuff a little deeper. I firmly believe that if this country had prosecuted Lyndon Johnson for telling the lie about the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Right.
I don't believe it ever would have gotten up to Nixon, but if we had convicted some of the architects of the Vietnam War, I don't even believe we'd be having this conversation today.
I
believe that to prevent it from happening to another generation, it is imperative that the American people stop stop waiting for these politicians who are all buddy-buddy behind the scenes anyway to prosecute each other. We need to stand up, and we need to accept our responsibility for what we're supposed to be doing in a representative republic. We are supposed to be the bosses of the politicians, period. And we are fettered to do our job by holding them accountable. And I don't mean you and I mean the United States collectively.
Right. Well, and one thing about Nixon going to prison, he wouldn't have gone to prison for war crimes and crimes against humanity. You know, it would have been for other crimes he would have gone to prison for. So.
Right. I mean, but, yeah, because he could have been very well convicted of war crimes also, but by expanding the war into Cambodia and Laos, which were two countries that had nothing to do with anything that they claimed Vietnam was for.
Right. So, Kevin Benderman, is there any way that my listeners could get in touch with you if they have further questions or have any comments about this interview?
Well, I'm on Facebook quite a bit, but
go ahead.
If they want to contact me directly, they can use my email, which is kevbdrmn22@yahoo.com.
So, Kevin Benderman, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We're going to get your voice out there. It's one that really needs to be heard. It's a voice of experience. It's a voice of reason. And we just need to stop the maniacs in our government from killing more innocent people and destroying more lives for their profit and for their power trips and for their, you know, their sociopathic tendencies. So, Kevin, I keep in touch, better touch, and we'll get you telling as much of your story as you're comfortable in the future.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I would like to add one thing. I believe the only way we're going to stop this now and to prevent it from happening to future generations is if the American people stand up together as one and prosecute these people that are responsible for these types of things like the invasion of Iraq.
Well, that certainly would make my life if something like that happened. So I fully agree with you, Kevin. So again, I don't want to say Happy Easter because I don't really celebrate it, but this is playing on Easter. So I just hope it's a really good day for you.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, that is War, What Is It Good For? Part 1. And I do hope you learned something and were inspired to look further and to really share this show with young people and people you know who have influence over young people. Because war, there's nothing ever good about war. So as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my assistant and assistant, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank Kevin Benderman for his willingness to share the painful story. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.